Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
True North Convenience Stores and Red Bull are an elite matchup. True North offers returning players Red Bull Original and Sugar-Free. First-round picks like Watermelon, Wild Berries, and the newest rookie, Red Bull Zero. Right now, grab three of your favorite 8-ounce can flavors for $6.50 and save 10 cents off a gallon with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your favorite app store. Rush into True North to score this deal before the clock runs out. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
I was really anxious to see things from the academic side of the house exclusively, to see things from the administrative side, from what I'd learned in my doctoral program. So I was really focused on learning that and trying to figure out how all that worked. I knew athletics. I understood it. But I went to get the doctorate in higher ed management so that I could understand how higher ed works. And that was really my goal.
And our guest this week, Dr. Karen Weaver, she is an adjunct assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education, but her career, a trailblazer in women's sports, one of the most diverse resumes you'll ever see. And Karen, thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here with you, Matt.
So let's talk a little bit about the here and now at Penn. What do you teach? What is your focus? I mean, we've talked multiple times, sure. Obviously a lot of NCAA, college sports, women's sports, but day to day, what's your focus?
So I focus on primarily the intersection of college sports and higher education. So I want to work with master's in higher ed students, doctoral students who want to get a degree to advance themselves, and also with senior university leaders. Help them navigate all of the challenges that we're finding now in college sports.
And it is a college sports landscape that literally is changing by the day.
It's really impossible to keep up with unless you're literally on your Twitter feed or something else on an hourly basis. There's so much legal issues going on. There's so many pieces of legislation to keep track of at the federal level, the state level, at the NLRB level. And plus, there's changes with conferences, with who's in what conference, whether we go from the Power 5 to the Power 4. What does this mean for non-Power 5 institutions? What does this mean for Division 2 and Division 3? Those are all the things that I think about.
Do you find it exciting and interesting, unnerving? Where, like, on the sliding scale of that, where does the needle fall for you?
At times unnerving, I have to be honest with you, because I don't feel like many people outside of athletics are paying attention to this, and yet we are in college athletics, a very important part of the university in many different ways, whether it be enrollment and retention, campus spirit, name brand recognition, you know, all those kinds of things. We don't want to take that for granted, yet some of these situations, some of these legal issues could literally put some of that in jeopardy, and that's what I worry about.
Did you always figure that your career would take you into the classroom, I mean, into higher ed? Now, obviously, you had coached,
yes,
and we'll get into that,
right,
and played in college. But was what you're doing now on your radar, or was it something that the opportunity came about? Or, as I talked about your resume, you just kind of put together this incredible life experience and knowledge that it almost seems natural to try to hand this off to the next generation.
Well, you're very kind to say that. There was no master plan here. I did know that I wanted to be in higher education. I felt like I had such a good experience as an undergrad with my teachers and coaches that I wanted to stay there. I was a coach for 15 years and then an athletic director for 15 years. And then I went and got my doctorate at Penn in the higher ed management program. This program, which is an EdD, has produced over 60 college presidents. And in my cohort of 24, there were five soon-to-be or sitting presidents that I got to know really, really well. And we had some amazing discussions offline about what was going on their campuses and whether they understood it or they needed an outside opinion. And I realized that there was a gap in the learning process for most college presidents about how athletics works. One of the major reasons is they come from the academic side of the house. So when do you get a chance to learn about it unless you're sitting in the chair? And that's a little bit late. So that has refocused my energy. I also have a passion for finance, understanding how the budgeting works, where the new revenues come from, how we spend the money. So those are the two areas that I focus on.
Where do you think the passion for finance came from? Did it come at all from being on the women's side, where for so many years the money spigot was almost completely directed towards the men? And I'm sure as a coach and administrator, you had to fight for things that on the men's side they took for granted. Or is it just you've always had a penchant for math and stuff like that and just always found it interesting?
I didn't think I'd have a penchant for math, but when I realized how the money was being spent, both as a coach and administrator, I was like, okay, now how did we get here? Well, who made that determination? What inputs did they make to give each team their budget, the coach, the salaries, those types of things? So I started to try to understand that a little bit more. Then when I began working at the University of Minnesota, I had all the internal operations responsibilities. One of them was I was the chief financial officer. So I really had a chance to understand how universities support their athletic program, both with university funds, with external funds from donors, from ticket sales. So I got a much better understanding of how these budgets work.
So now let's dig into your background. Field hockey, it seemed like, was your big sport. Yeah, lacrosse, too, or was it field hockey all the time?
I played lacrosse for a little while, but I really focused on field hockey because in my middle of my college career, it became an Olympic sport. For women, it was the first time it was in the Olympics was in 1980. For men, I think it was as early as 1928. So for women's field hockey to become an Olympic sport was a really big deal in laying out the structure of where you could go beyond college.
What was it about field hockey that first caught your eye before you're thinking about it on that stage or just, you know, growing up as a kid? What was your introduction and what made you fall in love with it?
Well, I don't think anybody who's listening is going to remember, but I actually played something in fifth grade called box hockey, which was a playground game, but we played it with field hockey sticks. And I thought, well, that's really cool. And then when I got to seventh grade, the Philadelphia Flyers were the biggest thing in the world with Bernie Parent and Bobby Clark, and all people wanted to do was talk about hockey. Well, we didn't have an ice hockey team, so I thought, I'll go out for the field hockey team. That's got to be close to the same, right? So that's when I started playing, and I just fell in love with the sport.
What was it about the sport that you fell in love with? Was it the competition? Was it the strategy? Was it just getting a chance to go out and just pour yourself into something?
It was the first team sport that wasn't sort of a summer rec league sport that I had a chance to play in. And Matt, I chose to be a goalkeeper, which is really kind of a different thing. People have always said, well, goalkeepers are built differently. I think we are. But I had a great role model in Bernie Parent. I just thought he was fantastic. And so diving around, saving balls just seemed like fun. And it really was for me for a long time.
How long did it take you to understand the goalie position? And I mean more than just, obviously, you know, I've got to stop the ball. But there's so much strategy, science, because you're playing angles, stuff like that. How long do you feel like it took you to really kind of get your arms around the position and be able to utilize all your tools to be successful?
Well, I would say that the position has evolved immensely. So when I started, there were only grass fields available. So that might impact your ability to stop a shot because it hit a turf of grass or a bump in the road. And you have a chance to really think about, okay, I have to line that up. When we moved to turf, it was a much faster game. And the angles and the lines became much more important. And your ability to withstand a shot 80, 90 miles an hour and redirect it to the open space became more important.
When growing up, because you would eventually play at Lock Haven and beyond, you mentioned we'll talk about the Olympics and stuff like that. When did you start to realize you were good?
Yeah, so when I was in high school, I had a coach by the name of Carlotta Bunny Schaefer. And Bunny is known today as one of Vivian Stringer's assistant coaches at Cheney. Bunny coached field hockey and basketball at Abington High School, where I went to school. She came up to me one day in the spring of my senior year, and she goes, Temple is having a tryout for field hockey scholarships. And I was like, wait a minute, I can get a scholarship to play a sport? Of course I'm trying out. There were like 70 young women there, all from different high schools in the Philadelphia area. I was one of two who got the scholarship. And I was absolutely floored. And I thought, well, I didn't look anywhere else. This is where I'm going to go because I'm on a scholarship. And I enjoyed it for 2 years. And I could tell that I was making a difference because all of a sudden, when we played against the powerhouses like Westchester and Ursinus, I was keeping the game close, you know, for the team so that they had a chance to win. And after 2 years, I decided I really, if I was going to make a move to the national level, I had to play for one of the powerhouses. So at that time, it was Westchester, Ursinus, and Lock Haven. And so Lock Haven had an opening in their goalie position. Their goalie was graduating. So I was one of the very first transfers to go and play for that team. They had just been in the national championship the year before. So I thought it was a good opportunity to play at a higher level.
And you mentioned that scholarship originally to Temple.
Yep.
You're like a vanguard here. You're one of the first through Title IX to get an athletic scholarship.
Yes, very much so.
Now you talk about that. Wait, you can get scholarships for that? How long did it take you to appreciate not so much the opportunity, but kind of like the history that you were right there at the crux of?
Yeah, a long time, because we sort of just expected it to happen as Title IX became more aware and schools deciding begrudgingly that they had to build their programs. The bigger schools obviously made a difference. The Marylands and the Penn States, the Syracuses could jump in with more money than some of the smaller schools. So we lost that competitive advantage at the Westchesters and Ursinuses because they didn't have that kind of resources. So I could watch the game develop at a higher level because they had artificial turf at those schools too. Then all of a sudden, because we didn't, and I know we're going to talk about it, but because the U.S. didn't go to the Moscow Olympic Games in 1980, the 1984 games were in Los Angeles. So all of a sudden there was this ramp up of really expectations because as a host country, we were going to get an automatic bid. So there was all this emphasis on scholarship play and athletes getting together and that type of thing.
So what are some of your favorite, you talked about at Temple being able to help keep those games close and stuff like that. When you think back to your college days, though, what are some of the first memories to come rushing back?
Well, I just remember playing in big games, and that was always my goal, was to try to keep my team close and being able to make crucial saves and also be able to instruct the defense in how to organize themselves so that we could do a better job defending our end of the field. I just liked the challenge, the one-on-ones, the collective efforts in front of me. I just thought it was great.
So you go to Lock Haven, and then you talk about when did you first start thinking of field hockey past college?
As a player? Well, in 1978, the U.S. field hockey program started offering Olympic selection camps. So I thought, you know, I'll go to these, we'll see how I do. And I made it pretty far, the 2 years that I was available to go to it. And it was on the path where I was in the final 24 of the 16 that would be selected to go to Moscow. And then Jimmy Carter announced that the team wasn't going to Moscow, which was devastating, absolutely devastating. So I had to make a choice at that moment in time. And again, remember, field hockey is not a well-funded Olympic organization. Everything we had to do had to be self-funded. And my parents and I talked about whether I could afford to just be training for the next 4 years. And I had to make a very important decision about whether I was going to become a coach or stay as a player. I didn't think I could do both. So I elected to go to graduate school. I went to Purdue University in Indiana, got my master's, and then immediately started coaching.
Dig a little bit more into when you learn that the U.S. is boycotting in 80. I mean, because you're young, you're probably, I'm guessing, you're cognizant, but you're not really cognizant of like how the world works yet and stuff like that.
Yeah.
What were the emotions there? Because like you said, you were 24 for 16. So the final team hadn't been picked yet when the decision was made?
There was a decision made. And then after that, because the U.S. government felt bad, they invited what would have been the teams to the White House. I was not part of that group, but I was part of the group that was ready to go into the selection process.
Well, emotionally, what was that like to learn that? And was it something, did it hit you upside the head? Or was it something that you could start to see coming even at that young age, like, uh-oh, this doesn't look good?
Well, ironically, it was my senior year at Lock Haven, and that weekend, Lock Haven hosted the very first indoor hockey national championship. It was a very new sport. It was six-a-side indoors, and that year the national team came because they needed another competitive opportunity. So we played against each other, and in the middle of the weekend, we got the news. So we were all together when this happened because we were all in the same tournament. And you could just see everybody's just, we had been so excited. We were finally a women's sport, a women's field hockey in the Olympics, and now it was being taken away. And nobody really understood it at that time. I mean, today we know It was because Russia invaded Afghanistan. But now after everything we've been through in Afghanistan, you're like, oh, you know, we did this. It doesn't quite make sense. So it was very hard. And each one of us had to make our own decisions. Some folks decide to stick it out. But even to this day, they talk about how expensive it was for them to fly all over the country and fly all over the world just to stay competitive.
And you talk about deciding to go to graduate school. Was there regret? Like, did you have moments of, man, I should still be playing? Like, there's the rational, as you said, you talk with your parents, how feasible is this? We don't have this type of money.
Yep.
But then there's the irrational elite athlete, like, damn it, I'm good, and I could make this work, and I should have done it. Like, was there a push-pull, or once you kind of closed the door, you were okay?
I still played after that at elite club level. And every now and then I'd get the itch when I was playing, especially if I was playing against one of my teammates or an up-and-coming player. But I realized that the commitment it would take would mean that I would not be able to move on and get a full-time job. It was very rare. I think the only one that I know of at that time in Division I was Karen Shelton, who was the North Carolina coach. She just retired a year and a half ago after 42 years of being there. And they gave her the grace of going to the squad halftime and to work at North Carolina halftime, probably because it wasn't that big of a deal back then. But in my situation, I was looking to teach and coach to get a full-time job, and that just wasn't possible.
So you get your master's from Purdue, mm-hmm. and then you start coaching, and you start at Salisbury?
I was actually the assistant coach at Connecticut College, and then I went up to become the head lacrosse coach at Williams College, taking over for my teammate who was training and practicing and traveling with the national team. She said, you're the perfect person to come in here and do this. And I coached for a season. We had a good year. And they offered me a position to stay because Chris was going to continue to play till at 384. But then I got offered the job at Salisbury, which was a full-time job, which was my job. And then I said, you know what, I'm going to go there. So I went. I taught a half-load, head coach of field hockey, head coach of lacrosse.
And just as an aside, we talked about, like, you know, the decision to not play. How much did having a former teammate taking that path and your holding down the fort for her, did it make it harder because you're kind of hearing about this? Did it make it easier because you're hearing about this and you're hearing all the, I had to pay for this, pay for that? Or was it, I'm focusing on this and this is what it is?
I think I was focused on that. I'd kind of determined my path. And the only other choice was to try to go back into the pipeline for 1988. But at that point, it was in Seoul, Korea, I think. So the team had to go through the whole qualification. So there would have been even more competition. So I had to realize the longer term view was this wasn't going to work.
So let's dig in at Salisbury. You mentioned lacrosse and field hockey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Field hockey, obviously, was such a consistent part of life. Where did lacrosse fall as far as playing and stuff like that? Was it always your number two sport, or were there times where that was in the forefront?
You know, I feel so fortunate that some of the coaches I had at Abington High School were so influential in the sport, with Bunny Schaefer, who was a field hockey, basketball, and then, of course, coached the Cheney team to national prominence with Vivian Stringer. I had an amazing lacrosse coach. Her name is Jane Oswald. She's no longer with us. But she literally just talked me into playing. She said, you'd be a good midfielder. Why don't you play this? I'm like, I don't even know how to catch the ball. But I played for 3 years. I thought, this is really pretty cool. And then coaching it at Williams, there's a certain culture around the sport that I really appreciated. I thought, you know, let's see how we do this. Salisbury had a very, you know, in a team in its infancy, so it was fairly easy to bring in stronger players. But we did really well really quickly. But the challenge of recruiting for two sports was almost overwhelming because you're just constantly going and looking at athletes in state and out of state. And this is in the mid-80s, so that wasn't a common thing to do. I sort of broke the mold on that.
When you do start, did you know where to start? I mean, you had the experience at the other, but now that it's yours and now that you're splitting, and I would imagine you didn't have any full-time assistants it was maybe a volunteer, or for the most part you?
Pretty much. No, I really just knew that I had to go out and find players who wanted to get a degree. Salisbury had a well-deserved reputation for education and physical education. We had good facilities. I thought we could attract there. Out-of-state tuition at that time was not bad. So it was not a hard sell to get student-athletes to think about coming there.
And you have success on the lacrosse side coaching at Salisbury, but field hockey, you take them to the top of the mountain. You win a national championship in 1986.
Yep.
When do you feel like you kind of hit your stride coaching? How long did it take you at Salisbury to feel like you had your arms around it? Even though that's, when you're doing two sports, there's always some kind of fire breaking out.
I don't think I ever really felt like I had my arms around it. It was like you said, putting fires out all the time. We had great success because we had athletes who wanted to be there, that wanted to work together. They were a tremendous group. And I really loved coaching them. And there wasn't too much more that I could do to get them further. I also had a competing, though, responsibility, Matt. And that was, I was a member of the faculty first. So if I was going to be kept on beyond my initial term of my contract, I had to get my doctorate. And it wasn't about just starting the doctorate, it was about finishing it. Now, Salisbury, Maryland is about 2.5 to 3 hours from Philadelphia. There were no doctoral programs at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore that I was interested in studying. I would have had to drive to Maryland, Baltimore, or to Philadelphia, Temple, to try to pursue this. How was I going to do that, coaching two sports and teaching a full class load? I just had no idea. I agonized over that decision because I thought, I don't know how else I'm going to be allowed to stay here, even if I win a national championship, the way this is set up.
But you do win the national championship. I'm just curious. And Salisbury's Division III now.
Yeah.
How did, what, were they Division III in 86? So take us through that season. I think you went 21-0.
Yes.
Like, did you feel coming into that year that, not that we're going to run the table and win the whole thing, but did you feel like, all right, we're going to be a tough out? Or was there a moment during that season when you're like, oh boy, this is, we're even better than I thought?
There was a moment, and it was when we went up to play Bloomsburg, who was the, I think at that point they were still playing Division III. They were the defending national championship champions or the number two team. And we went up there and beat them 4-0 on their field. And I was like, we made that look easy. Where did this come from, you know? And it kind of went that way throughout the season. I don't think we had more than a couple goals scored in one game. And then we went and played at the old Trenton State, now the College of New Jersey, on their turf field to win the national championship, which we had never won there before either. So it was sort of like just catching lightning in a bottle.
How did life change after you won a national championship? And I don't just mean at Salisbury, that is a line on the resume that turns anybody's head. Did you feel like you were looked at differently? And could you feel your career in athletics taken to another level because of success like that?
Well, I think so, because Salisbury at that point had not yet won any national championships in any sport. So we were the first team to do that, soon to be followed by men's lacrosse, which has become very, very dominant there. But also I was very involved nationally in the College Field Hockey Coaches Association. And around the same time as we won it, I was elected to the presidency, which is highly unusual for a Division III head coach to be doing that. So I led the organization from 87 to 91 and through a time of great tumult, because at that point we were coming out of the Grove City decision, which basically didn't require colleges to fund athletic departments in Title IX unless direct federal funding was coming to the athletic department. It's a very bizarre lawsuit that was filed by the Grove City College Board of Trustees. It was reversed in 1988, but there was a lagging effect over the next several years because teams were just being dropped left and right because they said, well, we don't have to follow the law. That was a dark time for women's college athletics because we had just gained some momentum. Schools were adding women's teams like crazy. They were hiring coaches full time, maybe not just as coaches, but they were hiring and they were investing, and all of a sudden we just hit a roadblock. So coming out of that, field hockey was at a tough spot. We're going to talk about going to Ohio State. When I went to Ohio State, my alma mater, Purdue, dropped field hockey, and I was devastated because I had helped out with the team when I was there, and that dropping actually took the number of minimum teams to become a Big Ten sport below the minimum line. So for the next several years, field hockey was not a Big Ten sport, which I think surprises a lot of people. But that's how close some of these situations were. You were losing important status and important opportunities because of this law.
So I think you win the title in 86. You're still at Salisbury one more year. And then, as you mentioned, you go to Ohio State?
No, I went to Ohio State in 1986. Oh, I was there through 86 to 87.
Okay.
End of the academic year, I go to Columbus. Yeah.
Okay. So that's, I mean, the Ohio State University. Was it palpable for you because, you know, Lock Haven was a power in field hockey at the time, but you're not talking about size of university, size of athletic department. Did it feel like you had taken a giant step up just in everything around you when you went to Ohio State?
The amount of intensity around me changed dramatically. And part of it was because of the jump, but also part of it was because of the uniquely way field hockey was situated in facilities and in seasons. So to give you an example, field hockey did not have its own facility when I arrived there. We were playing in Ohio Stadium. So that's where we were. So that was the stadium that was there when football needed it, in addition to home games. So literally, at times, we would get kicked out of the stadium because football decided they needed to practice in the stadium. So there was no continuity in it. Other times, we would have members of the marching band just walk into the stadium and start marching around the field or practicing their moves, that type of thing. And I'd say, you're going to get hit with a field hockey ball. And they were oblivious to it because it was generally just an open rec space until football came. So that was hard because at least at Salisbury and other places I've been, we'd had our own field. And there was the constant, you know, readjusting every time, you know, there was a decision made that football wanted to be somewhere. So that lasted for 3 years. And then we hired a new football coach, John Cooper. And John decided that the turf field needed to be grass. So instantly they changed it over, and that left us nowhere to play. So there was no other turf field on campus except for the football practice field that was about four blocks away. So we just went up there and we had the same problem. Every time they wanted to be on the turf, we had to find something else. So that became sort of a tone all the way through my time there of trying to figure out, how do I create an environment around a facility where it doesn't really feel like it's ours? It feels like we're sort of like the overnight guests, you know, that type of thing.
We need to take a break on One-on-One. We will have more with Dr. Karen Weaver in just a moment. But first, there's nothing quite like the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid when it comes to exhilarating efficiency. With hybrid technology and thrilling capability, these vehicles deliver an electrifying performance on every drive. Discover for yourself what truly makes these hybrids special. Redefine your driving experience with Honda, KBB.com's best value brand of 2023. Contact your local Honda dealer today about the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's return to our conversation with Dr. Karen Weaver, adjunct assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. How do you look at your time at Ohio State? Because you had success, but it sounds like in reading up, it was not easy all the time there.
I'm grateful for it. I have met some amazing coaches there. I feel very fortunate to have worked alongside so many of them. But, you know, football rules. Mm-hmm. And that was a lesson that I'm grateful that I have now. And I think they've made tremendous strides in moving field hockey to their own facility so they can control their practice times. They can control when they schedule their games. They can have camps when they want to. That makes a huge difference in your value to the institution.
Yeah, and not for nothing. I think people might hear and say, well, what's the big deal? Just schedule practice. Like, if you haven't been around college sports, you're trying to schedule practice around 24 kids.
Yes.
Class schedules.
Yes.
So you find the windows then, and then you find out the last second that,
That's right.
Football wants to do this because they're playing this team that plays on turf, so we're out. So now we've got to move. Like, it's just impossible to develop a rhythm and anything like that because you're just always chasing.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I could lose 7 or 8 players because they have to be in class, you know, so all of a sudden my practice plan goes out the window. One year I actually moved the entire practice from 6 to 9 or 3 to 6 to 12 to 3 because I had one student who really needed to be in a certain major, and the only time she could attend practice was 12 to 3. And I said, well, then we're going to move the practice to 12 to 3. That worked most days, but every now and then the punter needed to come out or the place kicker needed to come out. So it was a constant. Every day was something different.
How much did this give you an appreciation of, in the macro sense, how far women's sports had to come at that point? Because you are a varsity sport,
yeah,
and you're getting pushed aside for football.
Yeah, and we weren't the only ones by any means. I mean, the softball coach would tell a story when she was there that she was practicing in the indoor facility. And she She was hitting ground balls and then fly balls to her outfielders, that type of thing. And one of the football coaches came in and just decided to do his laps inside the building. And she's like, hey, I don't want you to get hit. And he just ignored her and she kept running around. And finally, she just launched the ball at him. And she said, I'm trying to tell you, you might get hit. And he's like, look, this is my facility first, not yours. It's those kinds of things that can really send the wrong kind of message about what's more important. I don't believe Ohio State is like that today. But I think back then, I think there was this sense, again, we were early in the career of Title IX, early in Ohio State adding some sports, even having their own facilities was still a new thing. There was a lot of tension there, and I think we shouldn't forget that.
How much did your experience at Ohio State kind of color how you look at things once you switched over to administration? I mean, you obviously understood from your playing career and, you know, everything of the work women's sports needed and doors they needed opened, but kind of experience it kind of firsthand with some of the stories you've told there, like, how much did that change how you look at things or kind of mold how you look at things once you were in administration?
It absolutely affected me because I wanted these athletes to be treated equally. And when you see the effort that each one of these athletes, whether they're a fencer or a swimmer or a rower or a football player, they're all giving their 100% best. I used to say to people, and I still do occasionally to this day, we don't treat them differently in the classroom, men and women. Why do we treat them differently after 3 o'clock in the afternoon? Now, that's the always a logic has been because they make money. Well, that's why we are where we are today with all the challenges with revenue and who gets to share in it, because we prioritize the revenue sports over everything else. So we've got ourselves sort of caught in a cycle here that's hard to break.
When you're done at Ohio State around 95, was it a decision that I think I've had my fill of coaching and I want to pursue administration, or did an opportunity come that kind of switched your track?
So I was ready to be an AD. I had worked with some really good ADs at assistant ADs at Ohio State, and I really liked the work that they did. I liked how visible they were in terms of being at games and helping me strategize through some travel problems or that type of thing. I thought, I can do this. This might be interesting. Plus, I can have a bigger effect on a larger number of people than just the 24, 26 on my team. And I, like I said, I'd seen good athletic directors. I'd seen some not so good athletic directors. And I thought, well, what I'd like to do is be a mentor to coaches. I think I can do that. I've had enough credibility in that area that I could be effective.
So where's the first opportunity? Is it Minnesota?
No, actually, Cecil Community College.
Okay.
In Cecil County, Maryland. And I went down and I met the vice president for student affairs and the vice president for academics. I just thought they were great. And they had such a student-centered approach, which I really could relate to. And they were ready for a change because they felt like the women's sports on campus. I said, I'm not here just for the women's sports. I'm here for all sports. I know. But the previous AD only cared about his sport. Okay, well, I'm going to care about all sports. And it was fun. I really just enjoyed it. I got to know the coaches and the teams, and I traveled with them, all those types of things. And at the same time, like I'd been involved with field hockey at the national level, I joined the National Association of Collegiate Women Directors of Athletics. And they invited me to be on the board because they didn't have many people from two-year colleges. Well, I guess they were impressed with what I had to say. And when the job opening opened up at Minnesota, one of the other board members reached out to me and she said, would you like to come interview for this position? I said, oh, sure, what the heck? And so I did, and before I knew it, I had the job, and I was picking up and moving to Minnesota.
It is a fascinating to go from Ohio State to Cecil Community College to the University of Minnesota.
Yes.
That's quite the decompression moment there in between. You talk about it being fun.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Obviously, it's a new challenge, so
yes,
that's part of
so.
It. But having everything kind of just ratcheted down for a little while from Big Ten, from you know, a national program like that to a community college where I'm not trying, you know, the kids still want to compete and still want to win and, you know, it's quality,
yes,
but it's different. It's different, but it sounds like it was just more, you were able to more fun and kind of let it loose a little bit more.
Well, I will say this, because a lot of my Cecil College colleagues reached out to me after I got to Minnesota. How's it going? I said, same problems, different day, more zeros at the end. I mean, really, that's what it was. Nobody ever feels like they have enough resources anywhere. So how do you manage that, and how do you get people to think about planning ahead and also managing expectations? I mean, that's really one of the hardest jobs for an athletic director. is you don't want to hire a coach who just thinks that the pathway is going to be clear and they're going to get everything that they need to win a national championship, unless that's realistic. And that's the thing I thought I could bring to value for the coaches, is that, okay, you understand what you're being hired for. I oversaw six programs at Minnesota. And they come in and they say, but I need this and I need that. I said, I understand that. But this is the process of where we're going here. And this is where you need to help your team manage their expectations. Those are hard conversations to have, but I had credibility because I'd been in their shoes.
So you were an associate at Minnesota and associate athletic director. So you're now obviously on the administration track. Did you miss coaching at all, or were you good and this was kind of a different type of coaching?
I've learned that when I shift, I shift. And so my college coach, when she got out of coaching, I said, "What, do you miss it?" She goes, "Only on game day." I think that's a good answer. I like that.
What was your favorite part of administration?
I think my most, and I don't know if we'll get there, but really the best experience I had was working at Penn State Abington.
And you were in charge. You were the AD there.
And the school was ready for change. They were embracing it because strategically they had already thought about it. They were hiring me to affect that change. So the school itself was very clear about what it needed. It wanted to become a Division III member of the NCAA. They were not affiliated before. So they knew there was going to be expense. They knew there were going to be facilities. They knew there were going to be more teams, more staff, more coaches. So it wasn't like I was surprising them when I came to them with it. It was still cost more money than they thought. There's no doubt about that. But I felt like I was helping the school reach its potential, and that was really rewarding.
I'm curious, as an aside, for these satellite campuses for something like Penn State, easier or harder because you've kind of got the Penn State name, but you're not Penn State, Maine. What is the dynamic there from an administration standpoint?
Well, we all know that the University Park is the hub, and they think of the Commonwealth campuses as the spokes. We are one university as a common, and that's true. We certainly have one budgeting system, one HR system, common rules across all the campuses. But I remember when we were trying to figure out whether we were going to go Division III or Division II, and my chancellor was having a conversation with the higher-ups at University Park. She said, "Well, we're debating about Division II or Division III." And the answer was very clear. We will not be Division II because the only campus that will offer athletic scholarships is University Park. So there was a clear understanding that we were different. I also had to explain to the faculty that we would not be building a 70,000-seat football stadium on campus, that we had no intentions of doing that. We were likely not going to add football. I don't believe they have football at any of the institutions.
No, I don't think so.
So there were some clear, areas of which we could grow. But we wanted to pick sports that were reflective of our student population. Abington's a very diverse campus. And so we wanted to think about how could we attract within the area that we typically recruit from.
How much fun was it doing that job at home?
Oh, I loved it. Abington's my hometown.
Right.
I came back, both my parents were still alive, which was great. That was one of the other motivating reasons to come home. I got to see high school classmates I hadn't seen in a while. One of my teammates, actually was a PE instructor, kinesiology instructor at Penn State Abington. So we reconnected. And it was just fun to be kind of back in the hometown and sort of see your old stomping grounds. But I also came home to go to Penn to take the doctoral degree because I decided that many, many years after being told at Salisbury I wouldn't get tenure unless I had a doctorate, it was time for me to get my doctorate. And the program at Penn really launched me.
With the idea of getting the doctorate, did you have your eye on doing what you do now?
No.
And I don't mean this job specifically, but really focusing and teaching and things like that at this level?
Well, I knew that I wanted to teach. I really enjoy teaching, and having a doctorate makes a huge difference. There's no doubt about it. As I was sorting through that, I had lunch with Dave O'Brien, and Dave is a legend in the athletic director world. He was the athletic director at Northeastern, at Temple, Long Beach State, and he had come to Drexel to start and launch a sport management program. And he said something to me that was very, very nice when he was recruiting me. He said, "There are very few people in this world I say this to, but you and Dawn Staley will be the only two. I can see greatness in your eyes." And I thought that, wow, what a compliment, because he hired Dawn Staley at Temple. And he says, "You just have it. You have it in the classroom." I said, "Well, I really appreciate that." And I was very excited to come work with Dave at Drexel. 2 years after I got there, he died of cancer at 57. It was awful. And it was such a loss for our department because he was really the force behind what we were doing and how we were going to do it. But I'll never be regretful that I didn't go to Drexel at that time because I was ready to leave Abington. I don't know if I was ready to leave that soon, but that opportunity showed me that I was ready to do something else.
And once again, you talk about when you switch, you switch. When you kind of switch to this, there were no, I don't even know if regrets, but no pangs of missing it or anything like that?
No, I don't think so. I was really anxious to see things from the academic side of the house exclusively, to see things from the administrative side, from what I'd learned in my doctoral program. So I was really focused on learning that and trying to figure out how all that worked. I knew athletics. I understood it. But I went to get the doctorate in higher ed management so that I could understand how higher ed works. And that was really my goal.
So you're there at Drexel for several years. What kind of closes the circle and brings you to Penn?
Well, I had great faculty members at Penn when I was a student there, and we'd stayed in touch. They actually offered me a chance to teach the master's class in college athletics because their former teacher had left. And so I started doing that on a part-time basis. And one of the things I said to Drexel when I came there was, I do want to continue teaching in the Penn program. They said, no problem. We understand that. And at the same time, around that same time, they offered me a chance to teach in the executive doctorate program. And I really took off with that. I just felt like I connected with the folks who were in the program. I connected with the content, which was changing so fast with college athletics. I thought, you know, this could be fun to do. And finally, I just said, beginning of COVID, maybe I need to do something different. I started podcasting. I started writing for Forbes. I'm working on my third book. So I feel like I've really shifted. And again, I haven't looked back necessarily because I still get my teaching bug, you know, filled at Penn.
Do you realize how impressive your resume is? I mean, genuinely, you've got you just check so many boxes, not just from the accomplishment standpoint, but also, as we mentioned, kind of at pivot points in history as well. Like, you've got a kind of a one-off as far as a resume is concerned.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I feel like I've been afforded a lot of opportunities. Some have been very challenging, I'll admit that. Others have been incredibly rewarding, more so than I ever expected. And I'm not sure there's much else you can hope for in a career to be able to have those opportunities.
As someone who has spent so much time in college athletics and has seen it from really 360 degrees, how amazing is it to you where women's sports are now as opposed to when you decided to go to Temple back in the 70s?
This is remarkable. You know, we can talk about Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese and Juju Watkins and some of the great women's basketball players of today. I played against some great athletes back then, but it's just nobody paid attention. And that's the key here is somehow, whether it was Sedona Prince with her TikTok video at the women's NCAA tournament in 2021, or it was, you know, Dawn Staley's greatness, it has just resonated with people. And whether there's a fatigue in the way the men's side was operating and it seemed not engaging enough, or whether it's just the momentary excitement of a Caitlin Clark three-point shot from the logo, there's something about it that has caught people's attention. I think young parents are realizing they want their girls to have the same opportunities as their boys. They see professional valuation in possibly pursuing a career now where you could not just make a salary, but you could make legitimate brand deals and market yourself. So I think it's a fantastic opportunity. I certainly would have loved to have had it, but I don't know what I would have done with it.
It's amazing because things like this, it's funny how, I mean, there's been progress. I don't want to, you know, but it was slow,
very
and then
slow.
All of a sudden it was all at once.
Yes.
You feel like it has gone by like a factor of 10 every year the last 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Matt. I really do. I just don't think any one of us can point to a moment. But I will say this, and again, because I study money and I study finance, it was when the investors came into the sport, when people saw an opportunity to buy low and sell high, that's when things really took off. Because where the money goes, that's where the media goes, and that's where all the other support comes from. I have talked on my podcast and for my book with so many great companies that are leveraging this time, this moment. One of the companies, Sports Innovation Lab, is doing some amazing things, capturing the data around the people who love women's sports. It's never been done before. And so then how do you create synergies with the Indiana Fever, with Caitlin Clark, with Toyota, with Wheaties, with other kinds of things that people just haven't done for women's sports before. I think that's what's really remarkable.
And the thing for me from a media standpoint, I don't know if I ever mentioned this to you, but the moment when I realized like women's basketball had arrived and things were different was when I was flipping channels and I came across ESPN and the talking heads on one of the debate shows were arguing the Caitlin Clark Angel Reese last year with the put a ring on it, and you know, they were going back and forth, and I'm like, yeah. Women's sports have arrived because the talking heads are arguing nonsense.
It's true.
They are turning nonsense topics and having 20-minute debates, answering questions no one's asking. Yes. And I say that tongue in cheek, but I was like, they've done it.
Yeah.
Like they're now it's not looked at as, oh, isn't that now it is. People are dug in, have opinions. You're seeing passion. I'm not a fan of the debate show, but I think that was a huge moment, kind of zeitgeist moment, where you really saw that women's sports, women's basketball in this case, had really arrived.
I saw a piece of that when I worked at the University of Minnesota. We had an outstanding basketball player named Lindsay Whalen. Went on and played in the WNBA, played on the Olympic teams. She caught lightning in a bottle, and the women's basketball team went to the Final Four for the first time ever, I believe. And you would have thought the entire state of Minnesota was following every dribble, every shot, that type of thing. Every game was sold out. This was in 2003, 2004. And then when we lost our coach at that point was Brenda Fries, who's now at Maryland, and Lindsay graduated. The magic wasn't there anymore, so it took it takes more than one player to get this thing going, and that's what we have now is we have a collective mass of good players coming through the system.
Yeah, because similar to that, and not to turn this into Matt Leon's resume, but I spent a year in Missouri, and it happened to be Jackie Stiles' senior year.
Yes, there you go.
At Southwest Missouri State.
That's right.
And I got to cover games. I was actually courtside when she broke the career points record. And similar, I'm sure, to your situation in Minnesota, not quite as big, but there was a community that was
right
completely
there.
Invested
Absolutely.
In Southwest Missouri State basketball.
Absolutely. But we saw it this year with Nebraska women's volleyball. My gosh, 92,000 people watching the game in their football stadium. And the tickets were sold out weeks in advance.
Yeah.
So there's this passion now that's pent up for women's sports that are leading the NWSL to award new franchises, to build stadiums just for those women's soccer teams. It's quite remarkable.
And on a broader sense, the NCAA, I don't think people appreciate, I mean, I think people that follow understand, but to the casual fan, I don't know that they appreciate how different everything is going to look in 5 years from a college athletic standpoint.
No, I don't think they can. I don't think many of us can, because the finances are going to look very different. The sources for revenue are going to continue to look different. I'm worried that we're going to lose some of our teams because teams will want to scale back their costs. And so I do worry about that. So we think we have to think about that in relation to the Olympics as well, because the colleges are a pipeline to the Olympics, and that's an important pipeline.
When you look at the big-time sports, basketball, football, some places, baseball, stuff like that, it is amazing to me that the NCAA didn't see this coming and a need to find a way to get money to the players. Mm-hmm. Because everything that's going to happen, and it might very well might be ugly, and a lot of turn a lot of people off, and I know a lot of people don't like the transfer portal, and I get it. But had the NCAA in good faith at any point in the last 30 years tried to take some air out of the balloon and make a good faith effort to say, we get it, we've got some ideas, instead of just clutching their pearls and declaring that amateurism is the only thing, as they've got people all around them making six and seven figures for their jobs. Like,
exactly.
How did the NCAA botch this so bad? Was it arrogance? Because they're not stupid people.
No. We're higher education. We're not supposed to be that oblivious. I think some of it was just the fact that they really believed that the 1984 Supreme Court decision, where basically the Supreme Court justice said this is an amateur enterprise, it should be protected. And so they bought into that. And the idea that they had something unique, something special, that was what was separating their events from all the other professional sports out there. And it had never really been challenged until the video games came out, and Ed O'Bannon is sitting on the couch, the UCLA football basketball player, with his cousin, who says, look, that's you on there. And he goes, it is me, because he had a patented hook shot. And he says, the kid says to him, I don't even think you got paid, did you? And he's like, wait a minute, why didn't I get paid for this? And that's what started. And they had a chance before O'Bannon went to the Supreme Court to try to make some adjustments, at least allow the athletes to have their name, image, and likeness paid for, but they got stubborn. I don't have a good answer for that, but that's why we are where we are today.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing to me because I think you would have always gotten to this point just because there's so much money and there's always going to be entities that want more, but they could have had so much more control over this if they tried to work something out. And I'm not saying it would be easy, but it also wouldn't be hard.
Yeah.
If there are programs in place, there are things you can look at. How did they do this? How did they do that? And now you've just kind of got this thing. You didn't take any pressure out of the balloon. Now it's popped, and now you've got this 4,000 kids in the transfer portal every year. Schools throwing $1 million at 18-year-olds, and you know who knows where it ends and what it looks like in by the time we get to 2030 or whatever.
And collective bargaining.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things that I think is really the linchpin in all of this is that the colleges are fighting tooth and nail not to have to sit down and collectively bargain with their athletes. And yet that would solve so many of the problems because that would take the antitrust issues right off the table. So the Dartmouth case will be a very interesting case to follow. We're waiting for a decision from the National Labor Relations Board in the USC case. And they have, in fact, not just filed an action against the institution, but against the Pac-12 as it formerly existed, and with the NCAA. If that happens, if the action is determined that to be legal, that then carries it over into public universities. Because right now, NLRB only applies to private institutions. So having the ability for the Penn State football team to unionize could be really scary because they might just walk out from practice one day. And that is administrators are very fearful of that.
Karen Weaver, I could talk to you for days. Thanks so much for coming in. This was great.
Thank you, Matt.
And that will do it for this week's episode of One-on-One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank Dr. Karen Weaver for coming in studio and being our guest this week. Now, if you like the show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on X at One-on-One Pod. You can follow me there as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next week when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
True North Convenience Stores and Red Bull are an elite matchup. True North offers returning players Red Bull Original and Sugar Free. First round picks like Watermelon, Wild Berries, and the newest rookie, Red Bull Zero. Right now, grab three of your favorite 8-ounce can flavors for $6.50 and save 10 cents off a gallon with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your favorite app store. Rush into True North to score this deal before the clock runs out. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
With Ring cameras, you can protect your home from anywhere. You're at baggage claim, and you get emotion alert. Check live view and see a guy looking in your car window. Luckily, you've got floodlight cam. So you press the siren button and let 105 decibels do the rest. Problem solved, home protected, bag on its way. With Ring, you can protect your home from anywhere. Learn more at ring.com.